the Hagman and Hagman Report. What a great segment. Sean, sgtreport.com. Talk about right on the money. We were talking about Pizzagate, and Sean is going to stay with us as well until the top of the hour. We've got another guest that you're just going to love. You are going to love the guest that we have coming on, along with Sean from SGT Report. I got a lot of respect for these guys. I really do. As an investigator and as an investigative researcher, I really have a lot of respect for Sean, SGT Report, as well as our next guest. And Joe's going to tell you about him here momentarily. Before we get to that, I want to mention that MinutemanStove.com. MinutemanStove.com, folks, go to MinutemanStove.com. Get yourself one of the best rocket, well, the best rocket stove on the market, bar none. MinutemanStove.com has the best rocket stove. You need this item for survival, for preps. Even if you go camping, it's 14 pounds. It travels clean. It's got this unique design that other rocket stoves don't. I could give you all kinds of information about this, but folks, just go to MinutemanStove.com. Look for yourself. What a fantastic piece of equipment for your preps, for camping, for whatever. And what an amazing Christmas gift that would make for that person in your life. MinutemanStove.com. These are made in America, and they're serving with our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're handmade, battle-proven, extremely rugged. They come with a 2-year no-hassle warranty, which has never once been made. There are no claims have been made. So, MinutemanRocketStove.com. That's that's the best rocket stove out there. Joe, I'm going to kick it to you.
Yeah, we have still Sean with us from SGT Report, as well as James Perloff. And James is an author of a number of books.
He's a great guy.
Shadows of Power, Tornado in a Junkyard, and The Case Against Darwin, as well as several articles. One I'm looking at now is on The New American, and it deals with Pearl Harbor, as we are on the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor today, and hence the show title.
And if, folks, if you're watching us on YouTube Live, and we have many people all across the country, all across the world watching us in YouTube Live, we're bringing Jim on video so you can see him. But
James,
I'm sorry, James. Sorry, sir.
either way is good. I'm good with you guys. Okay. Joe, Jim, Sean.
Yeah, and we're gonna go back to Sean for a moment. And Sean, you've done some interviews with our guest as well. But let's finish up with what you were saying about Pizzagate, and you go ahead and take us in the direction after you finish that. Take us in the direction with James, however you want to handle this. So, Sean, come on back and
okay. Let's thank you. Hey, James, how are you? It's good to hear your voice.
Oh, it's good to hear yours. I'm using that, used to do it through a conduit. Usually we're, have the direct line for your show, and actually we'll be taping one. I guess no one will mind my mention. We're taping a show tomorrow on SGT Report. It won't air for a few days after.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to speaking with you again. James Perloff is responsible for the interview that I've done. I've done hundreds of interviews, and the one with the most views is one I did with James. It has over, I think, 775,000 views, and it's called "The Elite Do Not Want You to Know That God Is Real. Here's the Proof." And it's a powerful interview talking about his book, Tornado in a Junkyard, and The Case Against Darwin. Very powerful stuff when you really break down that ancient Darwinian theory of how we all got here. What I wanted to do to just wrap up Pizzagate, though, if I may, guys, is I wanted to ask you about that Podesta Brothers police sketch. Have you all seen that as it relates to the disappearance of Madeleine McCain in 2007?
Sean, we have, and I've got questions on that because I need, and I've been trying to do this, I've been trying to authenticate the timing of those sketches. Those are so eerily right on the money matching. They almost look photoshopped and almost too good to be true. So what do you know about this, and help us out on this?
Yeah, one of the things I just want to say about those sketches, my friend Ole Domegaard has had the same exact question. He's very well versed in the disappearance of Madeleine McCain. McCann, I guess is how you pronounce it. I tend to say McCain. But Madeleine disappeared from her parents' apartment, their holiday apartment in Portugal, on May 3rd, I believe it was, 2007. And it was worldwide news, and many of the investigators, including Richard D. Hall, my friend Ole, many of them believed the parents had something to do with her disappearance. Now, What's interesting about those EFITs, they're called, those computer-generated sketches of two suspects, is that they both do look eerily similar to John and Tony Podesta. And what's interesting about it is that when Madeline disappeared in 2007, it was widely reported that there were some eyewitnesses, I believe two, and they were really looking at that point for one suspect. And I think even when these EFITs were released, and if you do a Google search, I'm with you, Doug, on these images. These are confusing, and Ole had the same question. He said he had been following the disappearance of Madeline for years, and he'd never seen those images. When were they released? Why were they released? Who released them? And I told him that, to my understanding, they were released somewhere around 2013, which is some 6 years after Madeline disappeared. And they are computer generated. And anybody that knows anything about generating anything from a computer is you need to have inputs. So what was input that caused the output to look exactly like John and Tony Podesta? Fair question. But it does raise this question. If John and Tony Podesta were in Portugal in May of 2007, did they potentially have something to do with the disappearance of Madeline McCann? And if that is the case, what role did they play? It's a fair question to ask because of the Podesta WikiLeaks emails and, of course, Breitbart's 2011 tweet about John Podesta being involved in the cover-up of child trafficking. So here's my latest thesis on that, on those images after talking to Ole and really thinking this thing through. Whether or not they were in Portugal in May of 2007, and it's important to find out if they were. And some research suggests that they may have been staying at Clement Freud's, the grandson of Sigmund Freud, staying at his million-dollar holiday villa less than a mile from where Madeline McCann disappeared. Now, I don't have proof of that, but whether or not they were there at Clement Freud's villa doesn't really matter, because to me, I would posit that perhaps they were in Portugal, because I'm going to play a soundbite for you that is an original. I did an interview with, it's a soundbite no one's ever heard before. I've not even posted the video yet. It's with a human trafficking, child sex and child sex murder expert named Corinne Hootspot. And I want to play that soundbite for you in a second, because I had no idea that Portugal was such a hotbed of child trafficking and child pedophilia, but it absolutely is. So here's my thesis. Let's say the Podesta brothers were in Portugal in May of 2007. Let's say they didn't have anything to do with the actual disappearance or kidnapping of Madeline, but they were there and they were up to nefarious activities. We now know that there's a global pedophile ring, much larger and much more horrific than maybe any of us knew just a couple of months ago before Pizzagate. Could it not be possible that this larger ring of powerful people that know what the Podestas are up to helped get that sketch, those sketches released, as a threat to John and Tony? Because keep in mind, before WikiLeaks Podesta emails and before Pizzagate, those computer-generated sketches of those two suspects would have meant nothing to anyone. But now, because of Pizzagate, people tied to, and you know, added up, 1 and 1 equals 2, these guys look just like John and Tony. So one of my theses is, Doug, that perhaps those sketches were released as just an open threat to John and Tony, saying, you play ball, you keep, you know, stay in line, or we'll pin this thing on you, which they certainly would have the power to do. So that's just sort of my latest thinking on that, and I hope people can look at those sketches right now. It's the John and Tony Podesta sketches that resemble the two suspects being sought in the disappearance.
Interesting theory. Yeah, very interesting theory.
Yeah, it's just curious, because as Ole said, he said, how would two eyewitnesses in the dark, who said they saw one person carrying a girl away, how would two eyewitnesses come up with two suspects, the drawings of two suspects, that don't look anything like each other, and end up being brothers?
Exactly.
And may well be involved in worldwide global child trafficking. It's really disturbing to think about, but I think it's something that needs to be asked and investigated, and you know CNN's not going to show those sketches and talk about it. So what I'd like to do, though, is just flush this out, and then I'll stop, and we'll turn this thing over to my good friend James Perloff. But I just want to play this soundbite from Corinne Hootspot, who is an expert in this area, because you guys got to understand, as much as Pizzagate and this child trafficking and pedophilia is a surprise to me and so many of us here in this country, the scope of this thing and for how long it's been going on, decades, even centuries, is no surprise to researchers like Corrine. And she told me this about Portugal.
Especially for little boys, they go to Portugal. And these children, in fact, there are prizes. When the children die during the abuse and the violence, then it is included in the prize to get rid of the child. And sometimes they end up, or when they are too much injured, they end up in organ traffic. Because every part of it, of a human being, can be used. Even if the child is dead, the bones can be used and sold. So then you have these children coming from different backgrounds and different areas, and you have the offenders, the criminals, coming from different areas also. It is like stamp collectors, you know. When you collect stamps, you will look all over the world to find other collectors who have stamps that you want.
Does that not just give you goosebumps? It's just horrific to think about children being used, abused, trafficked, bought and sold and murdered as just a regular business practice on this planet. It's like Dante's Inferno. It's like hell on earth. And the reason we need to talk about this and the reason we cannot back down when CNN wants to tell us that this is nothing but fake news and the Washington Post wants to label us fake newsers, we need to stand in stark opposition to these Orwellian monsters who are helping and in fact colluding with those that are part of this. Because if there's smoke, there's fire, in my opinion, and what Pizzagate tells us is there's all sorts of smoke. And what that Breitbart email told us in 2011, and I'll quote it again, this is Andrew Breitbart 1 year before he died, how John Podesta isn't a household name as a world-class underage sex slave op cover-upper defending unspeakable dregs is beyond me, end quote. If that were not true, Breitbart would have been sued for libel, slander, whatever, for millions of dollars. Nothing came of it. Of course, he died a year later.
Right. Amazing. Sean, right on target, as always. I'm just so impressed by your research and by your laser-like, acute sense of, well, thank you. And thank we will be talking more about this. You go ahead and superintend the interview with James here. I just can't wait to hear you two together. Dynamic duo, in fact. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, should I turn? Oh, James, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing good, and thank you for those insights. You know, we've been following the Luciferian character of the New World Order for some time. You know, William Guy Carr, who wrote Pawns in the Game back in 1955, you know, was with Canadian intelligence, and he said that the elite are Satan worshippers, and those later verified by the late Ted Gunderson of the FBI. And, of course, we've seen the Bohemian Grove human sacrifice, mock human sacrifice ceremonies. We've seen the Statue of Baphomet going up in Detroit. We've got a show on TV now called Lucifer. Well, Lucifer's the good guy. We've had the spirit cooking, the pedophilia. More and more it's becoming clear that, as we've thought all along, this is a spiritual battle between good and evil, between God and Satan. And you can see where the Satanists are. They are interconnected to the elite, and through financial power, they control the media. As you had mentioned, CNN will poo-poo this, but they're all on the same league, and we're on the opposing team.
Yeah. Well, I opened the show by just my part of the show when I came on by quoting Ephesians 6:12, James, as you know, and we mm-hmm. talked about in our interview. This is a spiritual battle. This is spiritual warfare.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I know that there's many listeners out there who are well aware of it. But, you know, for those that don't believe in a spiritual realm beyond this world, I sure wish they'd wake up. You know, it's just so obvious at this point that the people aligned against us, they believe in Satan. I mean, they believe in a dark power that gives them power. I mean, an atheist might not believe that that's true, but the people who oppose us believe it's true. So much so that I believe they're willing to really, really victimize and hurt kids in the most unimaginable ways, and in many cases, kill those kids and sacrifice those kids. That's what this Pizzagate thing is bringing to light, and that's why it's so important to talk about it. But, you know, you hit the nail on the head with spirit cooking. You know, they'll tell us that, oh, Marina Abramovic is just a artist. Well, right. So was Roman Polanski, but he was also a pedophile. You know, just because she's a artist doesn't mean she's not also a Satanist whose art is influenced by the occult and the practice of Satanism. She's on the cover of the Vogue Ukraine edition, all dressed in red, looking very satanic, and she is embracing in front of her, there's a little girl who couldn't be more than 10, 11, 12 years old, dressed exactly the same way, looking just as satanic. I don't call that art. I call it repulsive.
Sure, and it's she's also posed with a pentagram on her body, a satanic pentagram, and with a goat's head, bloody, cut-off goat's head. And I've been told, I didn't check this, but that her Twitter name is 666. You can't get a little more obvious than that. Yeah, we're definitely dealing with people who are conscious Luciferians. These people are not actually atheists. They actually are worshippers themselves, but of Lucifer.
Yeah, well, and also in that magazine spread of the Vogue Ukraine edition featuring Marina Abramović on the cover, inside that spread is her standing in front of what can best be described as the type of slab or table you would put a dead body on in a coroner's office or coroner's room. She's standing in front of it with very occult hand gestures, and the model on the slab is nude, but you can't see her naked body parts, her genitals, because on top of her body it looks like she's been gutted. So on top of her body are all the body parts. So then you dig into the spirit cooking thing, and you see at these parties they make these cakes that you wouldn't know they're cakes. They look like human beings. They look like naked, full-size human beings, right? In many cases, bathed in sort of a red gel that appears almost to be blood-like. And then they cut these cakes. They cut into these cakes, usually starting at the genitals or the heart, and then they serve the cake to the guests. James, to me, that's every shade of cannibalism I can imagine. I mean, that does that not just elicit the thoughts of cannibalism with these people?
And you've probably seen these pictures that have come out of a 1972 Rothschild-hosted party. And at this party, not only are they wearing these weird satanic costumes, but there are mock-ups of babies on the dining table, as if they were eating babies, not that they were really doing it, but that was what was being symbolized. And so that was over 40 years ago. So you can see there's a continuum of this going back to the days when they were sacrificing children to Moloch in ancient Canaan. It's ongoing.
It is. And, you know, Doug and Joe, I would just say that you guys remember the movie Eyes Wide Shut. I've talked about this in recent Microdocs. You know, it was Stanley Kubrick who, I believe, through that movie was trying to tell us what the elite are up to. And in that movie, he was really giving us the satanic rituals 101. He wasn't giving us this hardcore stuff about having sex with babies and sacrificing children. That wasn't in the movie. There was some suggestion of a shop owner who was peddling out his daughter, his teen daughter, for sex. So there was that aspect of pedophilia in the movie. But the scariest part was when Tom Cruise broke into the satanic sex ritual, which, by the way, was filmed at a Rothschild manor, Rothschild castle. Tom Cruise breaks in, and he doesn't have the right password, and they catch him, because when they know he's there and he shouldn't be there. They all have masks on. He has a mask on, but he showed up in a taxi, I believe, or a limo. Anyway, he didn't have the password. So the scariest part of the movie is when they ask him to remove his mask because they know he shouldn't be there. And they were going to sacrifice him, and then a prostitute stepped forward and basically took the hit for him. But even that was really 101 compared to what we're learning about with Pizzagate, because in that movie it was a sexual, you know, a satanic magic sex rituals with adults, you know, consenting adults, I believe. So that's not as bad as what we're finding out with Pizzagate. I'm not excusing it. I'm just saying that Stanley gave us a warning about what the elite are up to, and it was sort of the 101 Cliff Notes version, because what they're really into is much, much darker and includes trafficking in children, torturing and having sex with them in dungeons, and then killing them. That's what we're talking about here. And it needs to be talked about because it's the most important story in the world, I believe.
But and we agree, and it's not just, this is not just for naught. In other words, this there's a motive behind this. We can see that although there's the specter of Christianity or Judeo-Christian culture in our country and of course in the West or throughout the West, what is really taking place is the power elite, in my view anyway, are not atheists, as you pointed out. but they're Luciferian, and here is the proof. This is the motive, the means, the operation under which all big, in my view anyway, big decisions are made. Sacrificing to Moloch and praying to Lucifer. This has been and now is being revealed to be the means to power and the maintenance to this power structure, and of course who their real God is.
Yeah, and I would just like to, if I could, I think you guys are probably going to take over here with James at the bottom of the hour, so maybe at that point I'll say my goodbyes, but I want to give credit to a YouTube channel. The channel is Marty Leeds 33. He did a video that I think might be the video of the year as it pertains to this Podesta WikiLeaks emails thing. Do you guys remember the picture of John Podesta that was released because of the WikiLeaks emails, of him looking at the camera and he's holding up his hands, and his right hand has the number 14, his left hand, or vice versa, has a fish?
Yep.
Have you seen that? Okay. So Marty Leeds knows all about geometria. He's way better spoken than I am about a variety of issues. And I just want to play this soundbite as it relates to what we're up against, because the name of that video is called The Deocculting of John Podesta. And I highly suggest everybody go to YouTube right now, and if you haven't watched it, watch it, because it's brilliant. This man is extremely credible as he deciphers the cipher of what that meant. Why did John put a 14 on one hand and a fish on the other? And what he leads us to understand by the end of his short video, I think it's 9-10 minutes long, is that that is code for 322. 322 is the number associated with skull and bones in these secret societies. It's a very occult number. And I just want to play this last soundbite here from Marty. I want to turn off the audio. So I don't... Okay, this is from Marty. This is the last section of audio from his video, The Deocculting of John Podesta.
Dark magicians and dark occultists run our world. And the sooner that we come to realize this, the better off humanity is going to be. It's a hard thing to accept. It's a hard thing to stomach. It's a bitter pill to swallow. But we need to recognize this for our own proliferation and for the proliferation of true spirit upon this earth. There are very twisted, very sinister people that work in concert behind the scenes to perpetuate a very disturbing, very immoral, and downright evil agenda. And we as humanity need to stop this. It is literally in our hands.
I just think it's a really powerful video, and I hope people watch it, because you need to understand that a lot of the things that we're talking about here are hiding in plain sight, and that's why Pizzagate is important. That's why the research that was being done on Reddit before it was shut down. That's why the anonymous researchers on 4chan. That's why anybody telling this story on YouTube or in alternative media is doing the work of the Lord. This stuff is important, and these people have been hiding this stuff in plain sight for far too long, which is why all of that stuff on the Jimmy Comet Instagram page was discovered, because he didn't lock it. It was public. It has been since made private. So we got them right where we want them. We are going to uncover this, and we're not going to let CNN or the New York Times or the Washington Post scare us away by calling us fake news.
I don't think we could have said that any better. That's a marvelous summation, and incredible. And I hope everyone listens to Sean and heeds his advice. I did watch that The Occulting of John Podesta as well, by the way. It's a fantastic video, very compelling evidence with respect to the 322 designation, or the 322 conclusion. Sean, in closing here, as we've got a few minutes or 2 minutes here before we have to cut you loose with James Perloff. Well, anything? How do you want to wrap up here in the remaining 2 minutes?
Well, I just want to say that James Perloff is a friend of mine now. I didn't know James. I didn't, he's an author. He's just a terrific guy. I didn't know you guys were, but now I do. I stand on the shoulders of giants, right? All of this stuff I'm sharing about Pizzagate isn't because I solely uncovered all of this. This is research being done by real people who really care, and it's really important, and we can all stand together to be stronger. And I think that, as Maddie Leeds said, it is all in our hands. This is our opportunity to stand up. We don't have to be afraid. We can stand together. We can stand strong, and we can stand because we have light on our side. We have truth on our side, and the enemy does not. CNN does not. John Podesta does not. And we know Hillary Clinton does not have truth on her side. And so that's what's inspiring, is that we can all, like, I'm friends with you guys now. I'm friends. I've got James Perloff on my speed dial. I mean, this is cool. It's really great to be around and associated with like-minded people whose hearts are in the right place, who actually care about humanity and are in the game to make a change. Because that's not what we see from the people at CNN being paid millions of dollars a year to spew lies to us. I mean, literally. Jake Tapper, what do you think his salary is? I'm sure it's 4, 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 million a year, right?
Just a little more than ours. Yeah.
And a little bit more of a budget than we have. And all he has to do is, you know, read the State Department talking points. So that's not what you're going to get from those of us in the truth media. You're not going to get the State Department, CIA, Mockingbird media talking points. And I'm proud to be a part of it.
Amen,
so,
my brother.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really do appreciate it. And Doug, it's my understanding that you're going to be coming on with me in about a week, and I really appreciate that.
I'm humbled for the invitation, by the invitation, yes. Yes, and we're going to have a great time. Looking forward to it.
All right. Well, today's the day that we'll live in infamy, and I'm glad you got James Perloff on. He's wonderful. So thanks, James. It's nice to see you, and I'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you tomorrow, Sean.
All right, buddy. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Sean.
Appreciate
it. You have a great night.
You too. Thanks, Joe.
That was Sean from SGT Report. You can find the SGT Report on Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, as well as sgtreport.com. We're going to be talking with James Perloff, who is with us now and will be staying with us till the end of the hour. Getting into Pearl Harbor and the 75-year anniversary, we are here today, and we're going to be talking about this right after the break. Stay with us. Edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. We are joined with James Perloff until the rest of the end of the hour, and we're going to be talking about Pearl Harbor. Folks, go to jamesperloff.com. He is a writer of several books, as well as articles and important content. And one of the interesting stories that we're going to be talking about today is you go to jamesperloff.com and Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt's 9/11. Read that article. James, it's great to have you on the show. And let's get into this on the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. There's a lot that I think people my age don't know about Pearl Harbor that is very relevant today when we look in the context of our history, especially with the 9/11 in the rear view and a number of events that are happening now with the revamping of this World War III narrative. What's some of the things that you think are important that the younger generations might not know about Pearl Harbor?
Well, they might not know exactly what Pearl Harbor was, and so this was the event that launched America into World War II. It was an attack on our naval forces in Hawaii by Japanese aircraft carriers, killing about 2,000 Americans and sinking or heavily damaging 18 warships. It was explosions everywhere, a lot like 9/11. There are several points to be made about it. One is that, as you were touching on, we've had false flags, a long history of false flags that brought us into wars, or deceptions that have brought us into wars, including the sinking of the Maine, Spanish-American War, 1898, the sinking of the Lusitania in 1915, of course, Tonkin Gulf, your incubator babies, 9/11, the mother of them all, sarin gas and non-existent weapons of mass destruction. Right? There's been so many times we have been deceived into a war. In the case of Pearl Harbor, there are four main points that I think should be known. And these are, first of all, that the attack was foreknown by Washington, but this information was not shared with our military in Hawaii. It's also important to know that the fleet was set up for an attack in Hawaii. I mean, they were put there for that specific reason. Thirdly, it should be known that the attack was provoked. A lot of people don't know why the Japanese attacked us in the first place. And the fourth thing, here again we have a similarity to 9/11. There was a commission afterwards which covered up Washington's crime, and in this case they scapegoated the Pearl Harbor commanders. So Let's start with foreknowledge, guys, of the attack. And I think the very first part of that should be to emphasize that this is something that's been validated for many decades. And you can go back to 1944 when the Army Pearl Harbor Board and the Navy's Naval Court of Inquiry investigated Pearl Harbor, and they both concluded that Washington had complete foreknowledge of that attack. And in fact, I'm going to quote the closing words of the Army Pearl Harbor Board's investigation, quote, "Up to the morning of December the 7th, 1941, everything that the Japanese were planning to do was known to the United States," unquote. You can find that report online. Now, you might be wondering, why didn't the American people react with outrage in 1944? And the reason is that Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, suppressed the results on the pretext of national security. And before the results were released, he had new investigations done to supplement these findings. And many naval and army officers had their arms twisted. They were coerced into changing the testimony so people didn't find out the truth. But you can today. Now, in 1947, George Morgenstern, who was a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, wrote this book. This is a new cover on it. It was called Pearl Harbor, The Story of the Secret War. In 1954, Rear Admiral Robert Theobald, who was in Pearl Harbor commanding destroyers on the day of the attack, wrote this book. It's called The Final Secret of Pearl Harbor, subtitled The Washington Contribution. In 1955, Admiral Kimmel, who'd been our Pacific Fleet commander at the time, wrote Admiral Kimmel's story, a book which exposed Admiral Washington's foreknowledge of the attack. In 1982, John Tolan, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, wrote the book Infamy, which at this point more witnesses come forward, more information was available. He exposed the foreknowledge of Washington. In 1989, well, I should probably mention in 1986, I wrote the cover story for the New American. Pearl Harbor was surprised, FDR was not. I also wrote a cover story for the New American in 1986, so I've been at this for about 30 years. But in 1989, the BBC did a documentary called Sacrifice on Pearl Harbor, which validated all of this information. And in the year 2000, new ground was broken when Robert Stinnett published Day of Deceit based on Freedom of Information Act information. So this has been revealed by many sources. Captain Lord Safford, who won the Legion of Merit as America's father of naval cryptography, the greatest cryptographer in the history of the Navy, spent much of his life proving that Pearl Harbor was foreknown. So that's just for starters, okay? I just want to establish the fact this is not a tinfoil hat, but we've had leading generals and admirals and Pulitzer Prize winners saying this.
Yeah, and it's very well documented, the foreknowledge, and it is surprising to many who look back on it. You mentioned that this attack was provoked. How was this attack provoked?
Well, I'm going to get to that. Do you mind if I just finish with what the foreknowledge was? Yeah, excuse me. In terms of the foreknowledge, there were three ways that Washington and President Roosevelt knew. One was we had cracked Japan's diplomatic code. It was called the Purple Code, which they used to communicate with their embassies and consulates throughout the world. It had to be enciphered and deciphered by a machine. The Japanese thought it was an unbreakable code. They were wrong. The U.S. Navy cracked it in 1940. And we had our own machines that were decoding those messages on a same-day basis and sending the messages to President Roosevelt. And what did those messages reveal? They revealed that Japanese spies in Honolulu were sending Tokyo the exact locations of our ship in dock, which is a clear signal that they were targeted for attack. It revealed, those messages revealed that Japan had told the Berlin embassy, of course Germany was their ally, that war was about to break out. We even decoded their declaration of war before they handed it to Secretary of State Cordell Hull. So we knew the attack was coming through the diplomatic messages, but we did not share that information with our commanders in Hawaii, the Pacific Fleet Commander Husband Kimmel, or the Army Commander there, Walter C. Short. The second of the three ways they knew was through personal warnings. President Roosevelt and his colleagues in the cabinet received many warnings about the attack. Just to give you an example, Joseph Grew, our ambassador to Japan, sent this message to Roosevelt in 1941, quote, "The Peruvian minister has informed a member of my staff that he's heard from many sources in the event of trouble breaking out between the United States and Japan the Japanese intend to make a surprise attack against Pearl Harbor with all their strength, unquote. Also, Brigadier General Elliot Thorpe, you can see him interviewed in that BBC documentary. He was a U.S. military observer in Java, which was then under the control of the Dutch. The Dutch learned of the attack in Pearl Harbor, warned Thorpe. He sent a total of 4 warnings to Washington about the Pearl Harbor attack until he was finally told, send no more warnings. And if you go into this, you'll find that FDR received warnings from J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, FGL Weigerman, with the Dutch military attaché in Washington, also warned the Chief of Staff, General George Marshall. Senator Guy Gillette received information about the attack, which he shared with the President, as did Congressman Martin Dyes. So the list just goes on. He knew from many personal warnings. But the third way was what came out in Day of Deceit and the Freedom of Information Act. In that book, Robert Stinnett proved we'd also cracked Japan's naval codes, which had not been known prior to that. We were actually reading the communications traffic of the Japanese fleet as it approached Pearl Harbor. And here's one of the most significant messages. This is from Admiral Yamamoto to the First Air Fleet, November the 25th, 1941, quote, the task force, keeping its movement strictly secret and maintaining close guard against submarines and aircraft, shall advance into Hawaiian waters, and upon the opening of hostilities shall attack the main force of the United States fleet and deal it a mortal blow. The first air raid is planned for the dawn of X day, exact date to be given by later order, unquote. And obviously, guys, no one could read that intercept and not know what it meant, but those are the three ways that Washington and President Roosevelt knew information they did not choose to share with their commanders in Hawaii.
That's amazing. Mr. Perloff, wasn't there a revelation in 1979, I believe it was, about the cables, I'm approaching this from memory, so I don't really remember. Was there some sort of NSA or revelation or some records declassification in 79 or thereabouts where they released, like, I don't know, some information that perhaps the Day of Deceit was based upon or in part? Was it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
That's not ringing an exact bell, but it's probably something that's I've come across. We're probably coinciding. We're probably just not quite on the same wavelength as exactly what that was. But it's. Okay. I know it's tough with science when you're replaying something out of your memory and it's not fresh in your mind.
Yeah. All right. But yeah, I'm familiar with the Purple Code, the top diplomatic Japanese diplomatic cipher, which was uncovered. Wow, that's amazing stuff.
And what you just shared, a lot of that was news to me. I knew that there was foreknowledge, but the how specific it was is very alarming. And why would they allow this attack to take place? So we could get into the war? Just another deception, as you said, to get us into war?
Same as with the Lusitania. 83% of Americans did not want to get into World War II, according to the Gallup poll. And so they knew they were going to need another incident, and this is where the setting up the fleet at Pearl Harbor and the provocation comes into play. But they were definitely trying to get us into the war for their own motives. You know, they were looking to create the UN, the World Bank, expand communism, create the Zionist State of Israel, war profiteering, the usual motives that you can actually find continuity between this and World War One, when they had the created the Fed and the League of Nations and the Bolshevik Revolution. But let's talk about the setting up of the fleet. And this only takes a minute or two, but a lot of people, you ask them, why was the fleet in Pearl Harbor? They'll say, they have no idea. Normally, our fleet was based on the west coast of the United States. And in 1940, President Roosevelt gave orders that it should be indefinitely based in Hawaii. And the fleet commander at that time was J.O. Richardson. He flew to Washington October the 8th, 1940, and he vigorously protested this decision. And let's go over the reasons why putting the fleet in Hawaii was a bad idea. Number one, Hawaii is in the middle of the ocean, so you can surprise attack it from 360 degrees. Very hard to defend. But if you kept it on its normal berthing on the U.S. West Coast, it's impossible to launch a surprise attack. You'll run into all kinds of commercial shipping the Japanese would if they were trying to attack it. Okay, number two, our fleet was boxed in like sardines around Ford Island and Pearl Harbor, making the right ships right next to each other, super targets for a bomber. You miss one ship, you can hit another one, okay? Number three, you had to resupply the fleet over 2,000 miles of the Pacific to bring it, you know, oil and supplies and replacement personnel. Number four, you're separating the fleet from their families, which is bad for morale. Number five, Hawaii has very poor dry docks and oil supplies if you're trying to keep this fleet on a war footing. Number six, 37% of the population of Hawaii was ethnically Japanese. So if your relations are tense with Japan, you're setting yourself up for espionage and sabotage. Very bad, all these reasons not to put the fleet in Pearl Harbor. So in response to Admiral Richardson, President Roosevelt said, he gave him one reason for putting the fleet there. He says it'll deter Japanese aggression. Well, guess what? As of December the 7th, 1941, everyone knew it didn't deter Japanese aggression. But the media and mainstream historians never held Roosevelt accountable for this decision. Instead, all the blame was laid upon the Navy, who were the guys who were trying to prevent this from happening. But this was a setup. It was bait for the Japanese.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
Wow.
And, you know, you think about that and the amount of people that died, the servicemen that died that day. Mm-hmm. And you look at 9/11, and if they're willing to sacrifice, you know, that many servicemen, I think what happened on 9/11 had a very low body count for what it could have been, but you know, it just tells me back then, if, you know, 75 years ago they're willing to do this, what are they willing to do today that they weren't back then? And that's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, very important for us to understand history and how this repeated itself over and over again if we're to prevent something like this from happening again. But you asked me about the provocation, and here again is a question most people don't know, is why did the Japanese attack us in the first place? And again, we were saying that the people were against entering this world war. They'd wised up to World War One. They'd heard about the false flag of the Lusitania. The Congress had determined that bankers had made $6 billion in monies really stolen from the American people for war munitions that were never manufactured or delivered to the front. We're talking about World War One here. It's been very hard for people to be convinced to enter World War Two. And initially, Roosevelt tried provoking Germany by having escorting British convoys. Our destroyers were actually depth charging their U-boats, and the Germans were under strict orders not to retaliate because they'd already had that experience with the Lusitania. And when America came into the war, First World War, on the Allied side, that turned the tide against them. They didn't want to repeat that scenario. And so, in attempting to provoke the Germans, Roosevelt got no satisfaction. So, I'll give you a quote from, well, you know what? I just want to make sure people understand that what I'm saying here about provoking the Japanese, because a lot of people obviously feel very strongly about Pearl Harbor, is not just coming from someone like me. This is a quote from the British historian Russell Grenfell, who was a captain in the Royal Navy. Quote, this is 1952. Quote, no reasonably informed person can now believe that Japan made a villainous, unexpected attack on the United States. An attack was not only fully expected, but was actually desired. It is beyond doubt that President Roosevelt wanted to get his country into the war, but for political reasons, was most anxious to ensure that the first act of hostility came from the other side, for which reason he caused increasing pressure to be put on the Japanese to a point that no self-respecting nation could endure without resort to arms. Japan was meant by the American president to attack the United States, unquote. And one more quote from an Englishman, Oliver Littleton, who was British Minister of Production. This is what he said, 1944, to the American Chamber of Congress, and this must have gotten some people riled up, but he said, quote, America provoked Japan to such an extent that the Japanese were forced to attack Pearl Harbor. It is a travesty on history to ever say America was forced into the war, unquote. So let's talk about the provocation given Japan. Once they realized they weren't going to get any satisfaction from Germany, Harold Ickes, who was a member of the cabinet, said to Roosevelt in 1941, quote, our best engines of the war would be by way of Japan. So Henry Stimson, who was the Secretary of War, said this in his diary that autumn. He said, quote, we face the delicate decision of the diplomatic fencing to be done. So to be sure, Japan is put into the wrong, makes the first bad move, overt move. The question was how we should maneuver them, meaning the Japanese, into the position of firing the first shot. So how do you get them to do that? Well, Lieutenant Commander Arthur McCollum of Naval Intelligence presented President Roosevelt with an 8-step plan of provocation. And his report closed with these words, quote, "If by these means Japan can be led to commit an overt act of war, so much the better," unquote. Now, the culmination, the center of this eight-step plan of provocation was an all-out trade embargo against Japan, which we enacted in July of 1941. Now, Japan was very dependent on imports for its oil, for its food, for its many of its natural resources. It couldn't survive without getting these. And the Japanese earnestly negotiated to try to end this trade embargo, which was strangling them. And we said, "We want you to pull all of your troops out of off the Asian continent into Japan." And so they offered a compromise. They said, "Listen, we'll pull all of our troops out of Southeast Asia, all of our troops out of Southern China, but we need a foothold in Manchuria," which was basically northern China. The reason was that Stalin and communism were on the move. They'd taken over Outer Mongolia. They'd taken over the northwestern province of Xinjiang. The Japanese could see the writing on the wall. If both Russia and China became communist, they were going to be destroyed by communism. And they felt, just as we have our own Monroe Doctrine, that they had the right to create a military presence that would stave off the communists. Well, we said no. We gave them an ultimatum on November the 26th, 1941, and we now know, this is even acknowledged by Time magazine, the man who wrote that ultimatum was Harry Dexter White, who was an acknowledged agent of Joseph Stalin. And the ultimatum said, no, you must pull all your troops back into the mainland of Japan. You cannot have any troops overseas. I can imagine if somebody told that to the United States today. So the Japanese looked at it and they said, you've given us a catch-22. We can die by starvation for this trade embargo, or we can pull our troops back in and we'll die from communism. And they were right about communism, by the way. It did sweep China and Asia after the war, of course, and that's where you had the Vietnam and Korean Wars, and China became Red China. So the Japanese said, to heck with you. If you give us a choice between death and death, we'll fight it out with honor. And then they had that irresistible bait, which Roosevelt gave them in Pearl Harbor, a target that could not be resisted. So they knew they would get the edge, and that's exactly what Roosevelt intended.
Very interesting. And I'd like to point out that you do cover some of this in your book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior. Am I correct?
I open with Pearl Harbor. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. And folks, we're speaking with James Perloff. His website, jamesperloff.com. That's PERLOFF.com. jamesperloff.com. Just a magnificent wealth of information here about a number of things, history, and of course, the larger forces behind this rush toward global destruction. Go ahead and continue, because we've got about 6 minutes left here. I don't want to squander any of your time, so just go ahead and continue as you wish.
Well, Pearl Harbor is another one of those events in history that's advanced the New World Order. Again, it created the UN. It out of that came the World Bank and the IMF. Globalism, communism advanced. Communism spread all into the Balkans, and as we were saying, it swept into Asia and led to the tragedies of the Korean and Vietnam War. But it's part of a continuum. Again, Spanish-American War with the Maine, World War One with the Lusitania. I do have a very extensive blog post on the Lusitania called "False Flag at Sea," but that's been covered in books like Room 40 by Patrick Beasley, who was in British Naval Intelligence, and The Lusitania by Colin Simpson, excellent reading on history. And again, these get ignored by the mainstream press, but it's all part of that flow, you know. The Tonkin Gulf, where we were not even attacked, and we got into a war where we lost 58,000 American lives. And the bombing of Libya in 1986, which was actually instigated by a false messages from a transmitter planted in Libya by the Mossad. And again, the incubator babies of 91 leading us into fight against Saddam Hussein over the Kuwait issue. And again, 9/11. So again and again, we've been tricked by the same global elite, the same forces actually behind our government. And that's what my book, Truth as a Lonely Warrior, is about. It's really a primer, and I start out with who the global elite are, and we talk about the Council on Foreign Relations, which my earlier book, The Shadows of Power, was a history of, that sold over 100,000 copies. And that's the conduit by which the elite control our government. That's how they school their statesmen. That's how the Goldman Sachs guy gets to be a Secretary of State. And the book also talks about the Fed, the false flags, has a full chapter on 9/11, a chapter on the Vietnam War, a chapter on population control, a chapter on vaccines as a subdivision of that, a chapter on the international organizations like the Bilderbergers. It's designed to be a primer that you can give to your friends who are skeptical of these things. And I've also wrote the script for the movie Shadow Ring, which came out last year. It's narrated by Kevin Sorbo, noted Hollywood actor, made by Freebind Films. And we've got quite a few people from alt media in that, people like Joyce Riley, Ben Swan, Gerald Salanti, many other folks, Pastor Chuck Baldwin. And that's a primer also for people who are more accustomed to video than to reading, younger people. And it talks about false flags, the Fed, the CFR, media control, and the drive for world government. That's about all you can fit into a two-hour movie, right? But we're all working in this game together. You, I, Sean, we're all working to wake people up to this satanic order that is ultimately aiming for a world government. And you know what the Bible says in the book of Revelation, that the Antichrist is going to govern the world. Well, to govern the world, you need a world government. And we're trying to expose that, waking people up to the danger to themselves physically, but also the spiritual backside or front side to all of this.
Mr. Perloff, we only have a few minutes left. From the extensive amount of work you've done on these topics and where we are today in current events, do you see similarities? Are we on the cusp of a World War III type situation? Are we one event away? Are we a series of events away from that, in your opinion?
I'm concerned that we are. For one thing, the alternative media is, I think it's put a chill into the elite, and they feel that, that it was predicted by Albert Pike a long time ago. If you look at the world wars, that's usually what you need. To get the World Bank, they needed World War II. To get a global currency, they probably would need a World War III. To get the UN, they needed World War II. To get a full world government, you probably need a World War III. I don't like that cover. I never liked the covers on The Economist, which is Rothschild-owned, but the world in 2017 has tarot cards on it, and the death tarot card has a nuclear bomb exploding. I am concerned about the possible advent of a nuclear weapon war. I don't think they'd have an all-out Dr. Strangelove type ending where everybody gets nuked. They want a world government where people are going to worship Satan. But I am concerned about some type of nuclear provocative event sometime in the near future. So I think we need to be more vigilant than ever before and praying as hard as we can.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think one thing, this last presidential election cycle has done is woke up or brought a large number of people into alternative media, because they saw what the mainstream media and how biased they were towards Hillary Clinton. And I think if we ever had a chance to have the people paying attention understand, the dangers that are around us and the times we are in, it's now more than ever. I think we can affect the change. And my dad actually went and grabbed the cover of the Economist magazine. And as you said, that's Rothschild. No, that's the new one, the tarot cards. Okay, I haven't seen that yet. Can't get more obvious than that.
Yeah, there it is. Is that Shopper? All right.
Well, Mr. Perloff, we are at the end of the segment. I want to thank you for coming on tonight. And again, I hope we can have you back in the future to talk more extensively about a lot of this stuff, because we just only scratched the surface on Pearl Harbor. And you actually were born right by where we live.
We're not too far
from
this.
Northwest Pennsylvania, right up on Lake Erie. So. Very interesting.
But one more thing we have in common. Well, I always like to say that they've got money on their side, we've got truth on our side, as Sean was mentioning before. So thanks for being part of the truth movement. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for appearing with us. God bless.
Our listeners.
That was James Perloff. Again, his website, jamesperloff.com. And I'm sure he will come on again in the future.
Great guy.
Yeah, three books. The Shadows of Power, Tornado in a Junkyard, and The Case Against Darwin. And
folks, truth is a lonely warrior too.
Yeah. Folks, we'll be right back with Pastor David Langford right after these messages. Stay with us.